I'd like to call to order the Water Quality Supply and Treatment Subcommittee. Missy, please call the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Here.
Vice Chair Maggard.
Here.
Ranking Member Hart.
Here.
Representative Altman is excused. Representative Basabe.
Here.
Representative Bell. Representative Brackett.
Here.
Representative Cassell.
Here.
Representative Cross.
Here.
Representative Dunkley. Representative Gonzalez-Pittman.
Present.
Representative Gossett-Sidman.
Here.
Representative Henson.
Here.
Representative Overdorff.
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Temple.
Here.
Representative Waldron.
Here.
Representative Yeager.
Here.
Thank you. We do have a quorum, so thank you for being here this morning. Before we begin, please make sure all electronic devices are turned off. Or better yet, don't even bring them to the meeting. At any rate, it is good to be back. I hope you enjoyed your time back in your districts, and I know that some of us had some very difficult weather issues to deal with, but it's good to have you back and talking about water again. Before we come to hear from our presenters today, I'd like to welcome Representative Cross to the subcommittee. Welcome, Representative Cross. The focus of today's meeting is wetlands and mitigation banking. Approximately 11 million acres of wetlands cover Florida, and we have four sites that have been designated wetlands of international importance. Prior to development, wetlands covered approximately only one half of Florida. Wetlands are among the most productive ecosystems in the world, and they provide immeasurable environmental and economic value. Mitigation banks are used by developers and others to mitigate impacts to wetlands and protected species habitat and allow them to meet permit requirements and proceed with development. I very much look forward to today's presentation as we lay a foundation and understanding wetlands and mitigation banking. First, we'll welcome Jessica Kramer, the Deputy Secretary of Regulatory Programs at the Department of Environmental Protection, to discuss wetlands, wetland delineations, and activities in, on, or over wetlands. On a personal note, I've had the opportunity to observe a delineation in the field, and it was fascinating. And people say, you can't tell. You really can. And I'm hoping that we will have a little opportunity to go out on a wetland and hear from people that make those decisions to see what goes into the basic determination of where a wetlands line is. We will have time after the presentation for questions. Ms. Kramer, I believe this is your first time presenting to our committee.
Why I'm slightly mortified that you had to ask me to come up. I apologize.
Oh, no worries. And we are grateful to have you here. I'd like to welcome you and please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you so much, Madam Chairwoman. Thank you for having me today. My name is Jess Kramer. I'm the Deputy Secretary for Regulatory Programs, and I'm going to apologize in advance for the fact that I have a cough drop in my mouth. My husband and I welcomed our first baby this year about 4 months ago. She started daycare, and we are now in the cycle of her bringing home everything. And so apologies in advance for that. So we're going to talk about wetlands today. Clearly, the stage has been set on that. And I think to piggyback off of what Madam Chairwoman was talking about, wetlands serve a critical function, a number of critical functions, perhaps countless critical functions, both in our environment and also in the economic state of the state of Florida. And although they cover only 6% of the world's surface, they have quantifiable benefits that stem well beyond that represented 6% in the geography of the world. From having roughly 900 terrestrial species that they host through one life function or another of those species, to providing a host of water quality benefits, the full span of their attributes is really difficult to capture in a presentation via PowerPoint. Okay, I now have I'm so sorry. I'll get there, you guys. So at the expense of not reading off of slides directly, because that's something that drives me crazy in presentations, I'm going to have these up, and then I'm going to speak a little bit about them kind of off slide. So the question here today, I think, that I can provide some insight into is how do we regulate these ecosystems? So I'm going to start at a high level. The department has what's called the Submerged Lands and Environmental Resources Coordinating Program. That, as you start to narrow down, hosts the Environmental Resource Permitting Program. These are collectively the regulations that ultimately protect these resources and what we use to guide both ourselves and then our other delegated partners in implementing the protections of these wetlands and surface waters. Through SLRC's regulations of the activities in surface waters and wetlands, environmental permitting criteria are utilized to ensure that there is no net loss in functionality of wetlands or other surface water functions. So I think that piece about no net loss is really important, and I'm going to dive into that a little bit more later. So let's just take that and set it aside, but let's hold it in the back of our minds as something that's an extremely important feature of Florida's laws in regulating and protecting wetlands. So as I said, we're going to start big and we're going to narrow down. And so the next thing that I want to do is I want to take each of the three pertinent chapters that DEP implements to regulate these water bodies. Starting with Chapter 62.340. Now, there is a bullet number two, which actually walks you through the definition of wetlands as it's defined in the rule. So again, I'm not going to read that to you, but I think as you read it, you probably can get a feel for the broad swath of things that would be included in this definition. This chapter, Chapter 62.340, is referred to as the Unified Statewide Methodology, and it provides factors used to define and delineate those wetlands and surface water resources that we're talking about. Those factors boil down to perhaps too much of a simplistic level, but nonetheless, for illustrative purposes, are plants, soils, and hydrologic indicators. I think plants and soils, they make a lot of sense. There are certain plants that grow in these ecosystems. There are certain indicators of soils that demonstrate that you likely have a surface water or a wetland. But this term hydrologic indicator is perhaps a little bit more complicated or sounds a little bit more complicated. That includes things like algal mats, aquatic mosses, aquatic plants, drift lines, hydrologic data. Watermarks, those types of features that kind of fall outside of the plant and soil category but are nonetheless extremely necessary to determine whether or not you have a wetland or a surface water present. Next, I want to dive into the ERP program. And so this is housed in Chapter 62.330 and 62.331. Again, this is our Environmental Resource Permitting Program, and it governs being implemented by DEP. It again further governs how we protect and regulate our wetlands in the state. So this program is implemented by DEP, the five water management districts in the state, as well as two counties, Broward County and Hillsborough County. Now, where we have delegated authority from DEP to implement this program, that authority is governed by operating agreements that we hold with these other governmental agencies. In addition to the ERP program, which also includes things like review and use of sovereign submerged lands, I think what folks think about most traditionally is things like you're gonna place fill on a property to develop a house, or you're gonna do a developmental project. You're going to put in a dock, you're going to put in a marina, you're putting in those types of features. And so I think that's kind of what we traditionally think about when we're looking at impacts to wetlands or surface waters. But again, it also includes the review and use of the sovereign submerged land piece, more specifically for easements of bridges and pipelines, and so those types of projects as well. So it really is a broad scope. Now, which types of projects are subject to which governmental agency? There is kind of a delineation that we have, but it's a lengthy laundry list of who covers what, and so I'm happy to provide that if folks would like it, but I don't want to bore you to death by walking through each of the different categories at this point. So I want to transition now to talk a little bit about the 404 program, because while the ERP program is implemented by DEP as well as these other agencies, we also have assumed the 404 program, which is implemented only by the Department of Environmental Protection. So I'm going to just push this off for one more slide to talk in depth about 404, but I want to start this by saying, I think when folks are thinking about 404 versus ERP, do you need an individual permit over, do you need an individual 404 permit? Do you need an ERP permit? The most easy way to think about it is that ERP covers a very wide swath of wetlands and submerged lands in the state. 404 covers a more narrow category of those wetlands and submerged waters. So importantly, the ERP program applies to all activities within wetlands and surface waters, including activities that alter the land's surface. And so what that means is that you may have scenarios where you have an upland property, so not a wetland or a surface water, but it also requires an ERP permit to deal with stormwater runoff. That is certainly a feature that you don't see in the 404 space, so I wanted to draw that distinction. To dive into 404 a little bit, so DEP assumed the Clean Water Act Section 404 program in December of 2020. There are a number of provisions in the Clean Water Act that are governed by this principle of cooperative federalism. And the principle of cooperative federalism underlying the Clean Water Act essentially means that there is a joint implementation of that act by both the federal government and the state government. And folks will go back and forth on how far that reach should be in terms of federal oversight versus state oversight. But one underlying principle that I've seen through my career is that there is definitely a nod to the fact that states know their resources best. We live in our resources, we develop in our resources, we play in our resources. We know our resources best, and so there is some level of oversight that federal government would be missing in terms of the detailed understanding of the resources that Floridians have over their resources themselves. So there are a number of programs that you can assume from the Clean Water Act, one of which is 404, which, again, we assumed in December of 2020. Now, both programs, 404 and ERP, require a principle that's known as avoidance and minimization. And this is where I'm going to tie back to that phrase at the beginning that I used, talking about no net loss of functionality. So the principle of avoidance and minimalization is, and I'm going to try to use a really simple example. The idea is that you are going to avoid and minimize, to the extent practicable, your impacts on a wetland in any given activity. So if you have a property that has half wetlands and half upland, you are going to the extent practicable, attempt to design your activity, design your project in a way that avoids and minimizes, to the extent practicable, your impacts on that wetland portion of the property. Now, there are likely, and this is where I think you're going to hear about mitigation banking after me, and there's a reason for it. There are a number of situations in which you cannot wholly, obviously, avoid and minimize your impacts to wetlands. And so the concept of mitigation banking, which for us happens under the Uniform Mitigation Assessment Method, is what type of mitigation is necessary to make the functionality of that wetland whole. So where you have impacts that you weren't able to avoid and minimize, what is necessary from a quantifiable perspective to make that wetland functionality whole? Not just so that you're getting back the aesthetic piece of the wetlands, the plants, the trees, the soils, but the true actual functionality of that wetland, which goes deeper than those things that you can see visibly on a day-to-day basis. So DEP utilizes the Uniform Mitigation Assessment Method to score the functionality of that wetland. And then that scoring is used to inform additional projects that you need to take on, that the applicant would need to take on to restore that functionality, or in certain circumstances to purchase credits from a mitigation bank to supplement the mitigation work or to just simply be used to make the functionality of that wetland whole. T- To kind of wrap up, I think if I could leave you with a couple things today at a high level, it would be this. As we're thinking about the protection of wetlands and surface waters, I have been blessed to come into this program with some of the most passionate and knowledgeable staff that I have ever met in my career. They are passionate about what they're doing. They are highlighting the importance of these features as they're working through permitting decisions. And we will continue to work with our management districts and our other delegated programs to ensure that our programs continue to be implemented in a way that are protective, but also, you know, thread the needle of ensuring that we comply with the regulations that you all put before us. So that is a commitment that I think will always stand, but I also want to leave with the idea that I think one of the questions that I get a lot is this dynamic between 404 and Florida's program. I think that there is a conception that if you don't have a 404 permit, if you're not touching a waters of the United States, which is what governs whether you need a 404 permit, that in some way we're not being protective of the waters in Florida. And because of the wide swath of our ERP program, the great news is that we capture things well beyond the scope of waters of the United States through our state-implemented program. And so that's a question that I hear a lot, or a concern that I hear a lot, that I think, you know, having one of, I would say, one of the most broad definitions of waters and submerged waters, submerged lands, surface waters, certainly lends itself to being much more protective in terms of geography covered by a permitting decision or a permitting program. Than perhaps what we see in the 404 program covered by Waters of the United States. So I want to say thank you for having me up here and through bearing with me through my first presentation. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you, Ms. Kramer. I'm sure there'll be questions because, and I want to just begin by saying we are getting a primer and laying a foundation of understanding. We do have members that work in the mitigation and permitting, and also Vice Chair Maggard served on a water management district board, as you probably know. But for a lot of us, we're trying to up to basics. And so I'm gonna go to questions. Thank you for being, thank you for that informative presentations. First, I have Representative Maggard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for your presentation today. Thank you. It relates, but not really relates. Has the state come up with an opinion on the Sackett ruling yet?
You're yes. Recognized.
Okay, thanks. Yes, so the way that we are implementing Sackett right now with respect to 404 permitting is that we are implementing Sackett first and foremost, and then where Sackett leaves things ambiguous, we are looking to the Navigable Waters Protection Rule. But I think if you've read the Sackett decision, where many of us had hoped that there would be a really fine point on clarity as to what is and is not a waters of the United States, they still managed to leave a significant amount of ambiguity into some of the terms that they use without providing definitions. So we are navigating, no pun intended, our way through that right now. But that's our general guidepost for how we're doing it.
And in case I'm used to hearing SCOTUS, so Sackett, Supreme Court of the United States, right? So everybody, no, tell me what? Correcting me, what is it?
Sackett is the name of the plaintiff that
the
brought
plaintiff.
The case
okay.
before the
okay.
Supreme Court.
All right, it's a Supreme Court ruling. I got you. Okay, thank you. And I did not know the plaintiff's name, and I was trying to get clarity on that, so thank you. Well, when we're very familiar with things and we use shortcuts, I just want to make sure, because we do also have the public watches as well. So we have a case, Sackett, which was before the Supreme Court of the United States regarding what is WOTUS. And that's been a discussion that's been going on for waters of the United States. So I'm doing it myself. All right. Thank you. Next, we have Representative Hart.
Thank you for your presentation. Of course, I don't know a whole lot about water, right? I'm new. But I am somewhat concerned because I keep hearing that we have a severe backlog of permits since the state took it over. Can you kind of walk me through where we are in this backlog and what are we doing to try and clear it?
Absolutely. So as you can imagine, in taking over a new program, that always comes with hurdles to begin implementation. We've been implementing now for a couple of years, and I think part of what we needed to do internally was to come up with an assessment of the resources we've needed, which all of you have been extremely helpful in us getting the resources that we needed to implement this program, as well as dealing with the struggles that we just spoke about, which is kind of the lack of clarity on the federal perspective as to what is and is not a waters of the United States. So with those things kind of guiding some of the limitations on our pace, we have worked really hard to ensure that we are staffed to a place that is allowing us to make timely permit decisions and where we do not have enough information to work with the applicant in a quick fashion to gather that additional information to allow us to make a permit decision. And I think part of, I started in an environmental agency, and I think part of the struggle when you're issuing permits is you want to be sure that you have enough information to make an informed decision with the knowledge that you can't likely have all of the information. You can't have 100% of the information. And so it's also been working with staff to help empower them to feel that they can make decisions based on enough information and make educated decisions without necessarily having the entire universe of information that we would love to have, but we likely don't have.
One follow-up, Madam Chair.
Certainly.
Thank you very much. So can you give me an idea, though, what our backlog looks like in numbers? Or if you know, if not.
You're recognized.
Let me follow up with you on that.
Okay.
I can get you that information.
Thank you. And we have heard probably all of us in our districts issues with the 404 takeover, but I can see how not having clarity on what we have authority over could cause a rub between the state and the federal level, friction. So it's good to have that clarity is coming. May I ask, how long ago did we get that ruling, the Sackett ruling?
In May. In May of this year.
May.
So we've had it for a little bit, but in the meantime, then EPA, also the Environmental Protection Agency, came out with an updated rule on their side. And so we are now also working through laying that rule on top of Sackett to kind of get a better understanding of the federal perspective of what is and is not a waters of the United States.
Well, thank you. Representative Castle, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your presentation. Sticking with the Sackett decision, are we currently seeing or have you received any permits for projects that involve wetlands that fall in that ambiguity and you don't necessarily know which rule to follow, or are we just dealing with a potential ambiguity for a future issue?
You're recognized.
Yes, we do have projects that fall into that ambiguity, and so it's more so right now trying to figure out what the words mean where we don't have a clear definition of what they mean. And also, from a policy perspective, you have the legal side of it and the four corners that we all try to operate within. But then there is at a certain point the policy decision that needs to be made so that we don't entirely hold up issuance of permits in the state until we get clarity, which may never happen. So it's you know, making the policy decision that threads the needle of ensuring that we're complying with the laws and also issuing permits while being protective and threading the needle of all the obligations that we have to meet.
Thank you. Representative Cassell has a follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in the situation that you're talking about where we've got this sort of ambiguous application, are you here asking the legislature to implement some legislation that we then provide clarification? Do you have to go back to the Supreme Court and get those definitions? Or are you guys creating best practice rules to clarify that ambiguity? And are we erring on the side of conservation over development?
I think that's kind of outside of the scope of today, but is that a question you feel comfortable addressing?
It's not,
okay.
But
okay.
I am more than happy to get back to you to walk through it and to kind of unpack all of the pieces.
Right. This is kind of a primer, and she's already kind of a little over the scope, and it's been very generous in answering questions that she has information about. Okay. Representative Overdorf also has a follow-up.
Actually, just wanted to speak directly to Representative Cassell. Some of the things that we're talking about today in the 404 program, you have to remember that the 404 program is also now with the EPA still. They've just delegated the authority to the DEP. So we're still following federal guidance associated with SACCET, but it's a quote-unquote different program. So when we're talking today about the state wetlands and then we're talking about 404, remember that 404 is still a federal program. So we as state legislators can't necessarily develop a federal rule. So as we're under that. We've been given the authority to go ahead and delineate, but we're delineating based on federal rules for that 404 program, and it includes SACCET, that includes retained waters, and the DEP has done a great job with the retained waters rule that has allowed us to do this. So just two different boxes. I know it can get really confusing, but she's done a great job in explaining what she can today.
Thank you. It is a lot, and that's part of why we wanted to have just one session just to understand the basics. Thank you. Representative Cross, you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate this presentation. Can you walk us through a little bit of how the decision-making and the permitting process would be different for a wetland that is directly connected to a navigable water of the U.S. compared to something that may be isolated, may be an ephemeral pond that's only, you know, hydrated for certain periods of the year?
I think we're probably getting a little over outside of the boundary of what we were talking, and maybe some of these questions should be taken outside. But if you are feel ready and want to take a swing at that, you're welcome.
If it's all right, I'd prefer to follow up on that and have a conversation, an additional conversation following up on walking through that process.
Okay. All right. Representative Henson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for bringing us this presentation. I don't know that my question has anything to do with permitting or 404. I want an understanding because of my love of the land. Is there a relationship or connectivity between wetlands in a sort of family or system? Are they connected in any way?
I'm not sure I understand the question, Representative Henson.
So is one body of water connected to another body of water in a sort of system?
Maybe basins. Maybe. You're recognized.
Thank you. Yeah, so, and I think actually your question is fundamental to a lot of the uncertainty that we see in the federal space, which is what is connected and what is not connected in terms of extending jurisdictional authority. So yes, you do see systems where there is connectivity.
Yeah. Thank you. So this has to do with a statement you made about no net loss of functionality. How does mitigating one body of water affect another body of water?
Nice.
Thank you. So the goal with, and maybe let's, if it's okay to start with one body of water, and then I think it'll hopefully be a little bit more clear as to how that it would extend to another. To the extent that you have a connection and you're dealing with both of those bodies of water falling under the purview of an ERP permit, for example, what you would do is, again, the activity, you would take an assessment of the activity to ensure that you are minimizing and avoiding impacts to wetlands or surface waters to the extent practicable. And say, I'm going to do some rough math here. So, and math is not my strong suit, but I'm going to give it a shot. Say that you can avoid minimization and avoidance of the impacts to the wetland or the water by 75%. Mm. You still have 25% functionality that you need to achieve. And so whether that is doing additional mitigation projects itself, which again, that you, ma'am, that I was talking about is the tool that we use to come up with that kind of quantifiable system. So whether you do projects that, to kind of achieve the benefit that would be the same, determined the same as that other 25% that you can't avoid and minimize, or you buy credits from a mitigation bank that are assessed to be the same value of that remaining 25%. So that's whether it's one body or there's a connection that's sufficient to, you know, join them together, it would be treated the same.
I appreciate that explanation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Overdorf, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you. So we've had a variety of programs, whether it be the FWC's Go for Tortoise program, where you now have Go for Tortoise agents. Used to be a federal permitting program that allowed for federal delineators that were privately employed. I know that DEP is going through a fair amount of staffing, and on the lower level, we're now seeing where private individuals cannot get an informal jurisdictional determination, so without going through the actual permitting process. As you can imagine, that's caused a bit of consternation within landowners. So wondering if DEP might be able to explore looking at ways that we can have a certified wetland evaluator that is now on the private side instead, and if you will, copy some of the similar principles that FWC has seen, looking at ways that we can privatize, at least on that first level, whether it be a delineator, as you are going through the electronic ERP process, you're requiring private individuals anyway to go ahead with a variety of permitting and take on that responsibility and the evaluation of that permit. So just wondering if there's a possibility, and I know that this probably is not your decision, I get that, but I'd like to put it out there that there's an opportunity that the private side could potentially become certified wetland evaluators and looking at ways that we can actually do the delineations as well and have that accepted by the state.
I'm going to take that as an observation and not a question, because I'm pretty sure that that's not one that you'd like to take up today. But I want to really thank you for this very informative introduction. And I know that there are questions and more questions that might come up and more detailed discussions as we deal with this changing roles in relation to wetlands and our responsibilities to protect and have a good enough economy that we can do good things for Florida's water. Finding that good balance, that's really important. So, is there any other questions? Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
We hope you'll come back again sometime. Okay. All right.
Absolutely.
Thanks. All right. Next, I'd like to welcome Christine Wenzel, Regulatory Manager Division of Regulatory Services at St. John's River Water Management District, to talk to us about basic education on mitigation banks, the purpose of the banks, how mitigation banks are created, what mitigation banks do, where they are located, and the regulation of mitigation banks. We will have time after the presentation for questions, and I think that Ms. Kramer did a nice job of setting us up for this is a perfect segue. So thank you. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Try to get my presentation up here. I'm not sure. There we are. Terrific. Madam Chair, committee members, thank you so much for having me. My name is Christine Wenzel. I am a regulatory manager with the St. John's River Water Management District, and I am so appreciative to have this time with you. Today, we're hopefully going to talk about mitigation banks, and we're hopeful that we're going to be able to answer some questions that you might have or questions that you might be getting out there from the public. We have a list of items that we're hopeful to cover. That is, what is mitigation used for? What is a mitigation bank? How do they work? How are they permitted? How are they regulated? And generally speaking, where they're located in the state of Florida right now. Getting the hang of this. So what is mitigation used for? Let me start off by going back to what Deputy Secretary Kramer discussed. Mitigation is used to offset functional loss associated with ERP permitting. And the water management districts and DEP have been tasked with implementation of the statewide environmental resource permit program, which is under Chapter 62330. That allows for construction development permits of all different types. And as was alluded, some of those are addressed by the water management district and some of those are addressed by Florida Department of Environmental Protection. But those developments, when they come in for a statewide ERP, we are looking at water quality, we're looking at water quantity, which is often referred to as flooding issues, and we're also looking at wetland impacts under those applications, if there are wetlands on the site or immediately adjacent to the site. As was discussed, we're looking, it was referred to as avoidance and minimization. We often call it elimination and reduction of wetland impacts, but we're looking to ensure that the applicant has reduced or eliminated wetlands to the extent practicable. And that might look like a roadway associated with a wetland crossing. And we've shifted that roadway to a position in the wetland where it's the narrowest point of the wetland. Or perhaps we've relocated a road around a wetland or resource out in a development site. We might, once impacts have been reduced, then we switch to how are we going to offset those functions? And as we talked about those functions, wetlands have a variety of functions, and so we're looking for mitigation to offset those functions. We calculate the functional loss using UMAM, the Unified Mitigation Assessment Method that we talked about or that was previously alluded to. And once again, we're talking about total functional or a net function of loss. Mitigation is then proposed. There we go. So what are some mitigation options? We have a lot of tools in the toolbox. Mitigation might include preservation of high-quality wetlands or uplands on a project site. That usually includes encumbering them under a conservation easement so that the integrity of those systems remain. And it decreases the potential for construction, for timbering operations, things that might degrade the functional value of that wetland. Wetland creation is an option. That is where we take an upland that is usually adjacent to a wetland, and it's usually excavated out to match that adjacent wetland grade, and then it will take on the functions of that adjacent wetland. So we've created a wetland out of an upland. Another option might be to enhance wetlands. So if we have wetlands that have been altered as a result of different operations, perhaps ditching, trail road placement that's changed the hydrology, we could do things to that wetland system to enhance it, bring back additional functions that it has lost as a result of those changes. We could implement restoration. If we have a trail road that is through a wetland, that trail road could be removed, and now we bring it back down to wetland grade, and we have the functions restored in that footprint of where the trail road was. And last and not least is the purchase of mitigation bank credits. Mitigation bank credits are a viable option for mitigation, and they've been used quite frequently in the last 10, 12 years as the go-to for mitigation options. So, what is a mitigation bank? Mitigation banks are often large-scale pieces of property. They often are hundreds, to thousands of acres of property. They are generally a variety of habitats. Most mitigation bankers are looking, when they're looking at a prospective site, they're looking for a site that's been altered to some extent that they can make improvements to. And so they're looking for the ability to revert an altered site back to its historic native community types. These native community types might include forested wetlands versus herbaceous wetlands. They might include saltwater habitat versus freshwater habitat. So there are all different types of functions that the bankers might be aiming to replace. Mitigation banks are often, not always, but often located adjacent to publicly owned lands. so that they, when the mitigation bank is functioning, are functioning in conjunction with those adjacent resources. And those mitigation banks serve as an extension of that habitat for fish and wildlife. Generally speaking, the mitigation bank improves the overall regional watershed within which it is located. A mitigation bank has an established number of credits. As we talked about doing a UMAM evaluation on an impact area, we also do a UMAM evaluation on a mitigation area. And that UMAM evaluation establishes or demonstrates what the lift is, what the ecological benefit is going to be derived when the mitigation bank plan is implemented. And we'll talk a little bit more about plans and how that's generated. But credits are a way to put a number on what that functional gain is associated with this big piece of property and all the work that is occurring within it. Make sure I cover everything. Once again, we're trying to convert a piece of property back to its native community. For example, if we have a pine plantation, and I know you've seen a lot of pine plantations out there in the world where you have those rows and rows of pine. Historically, a lot of Florida was either mesic or hydric flatwoods, which means that pine was a lot less dense. We had fire coming through it. So a mitigation bank plan might utilize thinning of those pines and implementation of those burn plans in order to show that they have lift and establish those credits. The service area. Each bank has an established service area. The state of Florida is divided into drainage basins, mitigation drainage basins, and usually the mitigation service area for a bank is defined as the mitigation drainage service area or mitigation drainage basin in which it is located, so that the functions that are happening within that drainage basin are being offset at the bank that is within that drainage basin. This map indicates the location of, and we'll come back to it at the end of the presentation, but this bank or this graphic indicates the location of many of our mitigation banks here in the state of Florida. And the establishment of a service area ensures that functions that are lost as a result of projects that are in, say, Jacksonville, are not being offset at banks that are located in Tampa or Miami. The functions, we're trying to keep the functions within the drainage basin so that we can meet the rule criteria of a no net loss of functions when we're looking at the rules. For example, if we have a project in Jacksonville, a lot of Jacksonville is Basin 4. And so we want to look for, the applicants want to look for the potential to use mitigation from a mitigation bank that is located in Basin 4, also, if that's helpful. Finally, mitigation banks are managed in perpetuity. So these large plans that are being implemented, we want to make sure that that doesn't just stop once they get all of the credits, and we'll talk about how credits are released. That mitigation bank is implemented in perpetuity, so we know that the funds are there, and we'll talk about that too, and the management that occurs will keep going even after the credits have been released. Now, how are banks permitted? So an applicant comes to us and says, I've got a great site, I want to use it as a mitigation bank. And so we start looking, how does this property, how does their plan meet the rule criteria of Chapter 62342 of the Florida Administrative Code? The applicant submits the application, and in it, they have a plan. We call it a construction and implementation plan. It might also be called a mitigation bank plan, a management plan, all of those things together. And they are demonstrating how they are going to get ecological lift from a piece of property. We are also doing a lot of field work. We are out there looking to see what's happening in the real world and how the changes that they are proposing, can they be implemented? Are they a good idea to be implemented? The applicant provides us draft financial and legal responsibility mechanisms. Those would include conservation easement language that demonstrates that the area will be encumbered under an easement, will remain in perpetuity, will be dedicated to the Water Management District or the permitting agencies. The financial responsibility mechanisms are for both construction and implementation and perpetual management. So you have two mechanisms, and those are mechanisms established to make sure that everything the banker says they're going to do, they have the financial ability to do those. Those funds are often included in maybe a letter of credit or a performance bond, something along those natures. The success criteria is established for these banks. This is a way for us to show that that everything we thought that was going to happen when they proposed this plan is actually happening out there in the real world. So the success criteria requires monitoring, and it requires implementation of the plan that they proposed. And we'll get to this too, as that success criteria is met, then credits are released, and we'll talk about that. Once again, we've established a service area for this bank. So if we have a bank in a given drainage basin, we establish that service area to ensure that the functions that, so the projects that are located within that drainage basin that might want to use this bank will keep those functions offset within that drainage basin. Once again, credits are calculated using UMAM, and that is the same way that we're calculating the functional loss. So your functional loss from your permit, from your project, is compared to the functional gain, which is also a credit, at the mitigation bank. So usually when you have a functional loss of, say, one, then you buy one credit from a mitigation bank. That's how it equates. A credit release schedule is developed. So as success criteria is met, so we have this nice success criteria defined, as that criteria is met, then we release credits, and the banker can sell those credits as they're moving on to the next step. And we'll get into that a little bit more. And finally, once again, they are going to propose a perpetual management plan. We really want to make sure that in the long run, everything we thought was going to happen continues to happen on that project site. So we want to make sure that all of a sudden Brazilian pepper isn't coming in, that we don't have an invasion of Kogan grass, those kind of things. That's the purpose of those perpetual management plans. How do banks work? So once the banker gets their permit, they are ready to go. By that point, they want to get those credits. And so usually what happens is we release up to 20%. It varies. That is not a rule. That's just an approximate that we use. But generally speaking, once they record their conservation easement, they implement their title insurance. If we have any access easement issues, we go ahead and get that taken care of, get that implemented, and their financial responsibility mechanisms. Once all of that legal documentation is provided to us, we generally release up to about 20% of the total number of credits that we think the bank can generate. So if we have a fictitious bank, and that bank we think is going to generate 100 credits, before they've done any work, once they get their permit and once they've done the legal documentation that they need to do, then they will get 20 credits. And then they can begin selling those credits. Those credits will go on a ledger. And we have the ledger posted on our website, as do the other water management districts. The applicant start, or the permittee starts selling credits to applicants that need mitigation in that drainage basin. In the meantime, they're out there doing the construction that they proposed under their plan. If that's construction of a low water crossing, removal of a trail road, thinning of pines, implementation of burn plans, all of those things are being implemented in the meantime. Once that happens, an additional up to 30% of the credits are then released. So sometimes that can happen within the first year. I've seen it happen on banks within the first year if they are just going strong and they have their other authorizations in place. And so at that point, with our fictitious bank, we would have 50 credits that could be sold out there in the market within this drainage basin. Now, monitoring, management, maintenance, and Mother Nature kick in. At this point, then, we're going to watch and monitor to see that everything that they thought was going to happen on this site is happening. And so we are looking for this bank to trend toward success. We use that term. That success being defined in what we talked about, the success criteria that we established when we issued the permit. So they are going to be measuring the growth of trees that were planted. They are going to be looking at the number of ground cover species that have come about as a result of controlled burns. They're going to be doing all of these things. And so we release credits on an incremental basis over, at best, the next 5 years. Usually for you to get from one level of success to the next level of success in the monitoring phase, it may take more than a year because you are waiting for trees to grow. You're waiting for different ground species to show up. You're looking at densities of vegetation. So Mother Nature has to do our thing. So sometimes it doesn't happen as quickly as we would like, but we are looking for that to show us that we're trending towards success. As we reach those milestones, there's usually five of them, then we release credits incrementally. That is a little less established. Sometimes it's approximately 10% each release. Sometimes, depending on how the UMAM analysis worked, there might be delays in releases, those kind of things. And we are looking that the perpetual management and monitoring is going to be established and put into place as the bank is implemented. So we have monitoring stations fixed out there. We know where we're grabbing our hydrologic data. All of those things are happening during the construction phase and then filter into that perpetual monitoring. How are banks regulated? So when we issue a permit for a bank, they're out there, they're doing their thing, they call us and they say, we did a burn, we've done our thinning, we've installed our low water crossing, whatever it is in their plan. We go out there, we're boots on the ground, we're taking a look at what they've done. And we are trying to get to those very, very quickly because as a result, as you saw, as a result of those field visits, that's how they get their credit releases. So we're trying to respond to those very, very quickly so that we can get that, keep them going. They are submitting annual monitoring reports. And they are showing us how the vegetation is growing. They're showing us what the densities are. They're showing us wildlife that has been observed on the site. They're showing us what management activities they have implemented. So we are doing at least an annual site inspection. Sometimes it's more depending on what's going on in the bank. We take a look at their financial responsibility mechanisms every year just to make sure everything's still in place. That bank is still active, that and when I say bank, that financial institution is still active, that we haven't had some crazy changes in cost estimates for any type of activity for monitoring or construction and so on. We also do an annual credit ledger reconciliation. So we are looking at a bank, and as I said, when we do a release of credits, that goes on the ledger. When people buy credits or use credits for projects, that goes on the ledger as well. And so it's an accounting system, and we want to make sure our accounting system matches the bankers. So we get together every year and make sure that all takes place and everything is consistent. So my final slide, as I wrap up, I wanted to give you an idea. We're back to this same graphic, but we have 131 mitigation banks in the state of Florida that cover over 227,000 acres. That's a lot of property and a lot to keep track of. The bankers out there are hustling. I know they are. I work with them very, very frequently. And so they are really trying to implement these plans that we've permitted. We also have another approximately 30 across the state that are in the queue. So they are either in pre-application review or they are in application review. And so those are another 30 that we're hoping will be generating credits very, very soon. And that concludes my presentation. Thank you.
And thank you. And before I go to questions, I was thirsty for you because talking about water. Would you like
I'm good. Thank you. I appreciate it. Okay.
All right. Members, are there any questions? Leader Hart, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much for the presentation. I do have a question as it relates to the mitigation banking. Do you think that it's the mitigation banking is making citizens whole with respect to the loss of wetlands?
You're recognized.
Because we're operating under a no net loss of functions, yes, I do. That's our job as a permitting agency, to make sure that there is a no net loss of function. So when an applicant uses a mitigation bank, the investment that's happened up front on that mitigation bank site is replacing the functions that are lost associated with the ERP or the construction permit.
You're recognized.
Thank you very much. I mean, just wondering, do you think, though, that the mitigation banking really makes up for the losses for the wetland that we're losing?
I believe she answered that question.
I'm happy to answer if you like. Yeah. I do.
You do.
To be honest with you, I've worked in the mitigation banking program at St. Mm-hmm. John's for about 10 years, and seeing the functional gain associated with implementation of these plans is really something. It is something to be noted, and so I definitely, when I'm on a project site and I'm looking at an area that's going to be impacted, and I'm thinking about what are those functions relative to what I'm seeing happening on the mitigation bank sites, I do think that those impacts are being offset.
Thank you. Do the same people do the evaluations on both sides of the ledger? The people, like, do you get to see both sides? I'll follow up on that follow-up.
I had the advantage of doing that, yes, because I did both permit review and I reviewed mitigation banks and did compliance on mitigation banks. What we try to do is we try to have our reviewers that are reviewing applications for impacts go out to the mitigation banks sites so that they can see what's happening on that. And so we try to coordinate that, do some cross-training. Now we're looking at trying to implement some of our reviewers more into our mitigation bank program so that there will be a little bit more folks like me who did both, who are doing both.
I appreciate it. I'm just going to say, because I'm an old county commissioner, I don't know if we have any other local government people, we always see the loss, but we rarely see the other side. When you were talking about seeing the things come back to life, a area restored and life come back to it, very interesting. Representative Cross, you're recognized.
Thank you. And if I may be recognized for a series of questions?
Sure. You know, because of the nature of things.
Absolutely. Go ahead. Okay. Thank you for the presentation. Do we have an understanding of the percentage of these permits, these impacts that actually go and use the mitigation banks compared to doing on-site mitigation?
You're recognized.
I don't know that we do. What we do is every year we report to DEP what impacts are proposed under environmental resource permits, and we also report what that mitigation is. So I think that data could be generated, but I don't know it right off the top of my head, but I think we could get that for you.
Thank you. You have another?
If an applicant has a project and there is not a current mitigation bank in their drainage area and they do not have room to do on-site mitigation, what are their options currently?
You're recognized.
Well, we had those tools in the toolbox, and those tools don't need to occur on site. They can occur off site. So we can help them, and that's often what we work as a team trying to get them through the system, through the permitting process. And so it might be that I've heard from so-and-so that they might have some property, or this consultant knows of that person that has some offsite property that might be able to benefit from some enhancement or restoration. Mm-hmm. So though that isn't located on this applicant's site, we work with them to see if this offsite mitigation area would serve their purposes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Last question. Are any of the mitigation, the 131 plus the 30 that are in the queue, are any of those located on lands that were conserved with state funding?
If you have that information, you're recognized.
I don't want to give you erroneous information, I believe so, but we could get back to you and let you know about that.
Thank you. I was also interested if there were, because I know we have some impaired lands, I'm also interested in that question as an option for how we get, you know, the kind of results we need for our environment. Mm-hmm. Representative Waldron, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your presentation. Just out of curiosity, you mentioned all the options, and it seems like you kind of implied that most people choose the mitigation bank method. But do you have a breakdown of how that works out in terms of which option is usually chosen?
Didn't you kind of
do that? A little bit. You're recognized. A little bit. Yeah. I want to say most times lately, folks are using mitigation banks as their option. It is a good option. It is usually a very efficient option for an applicant, but they are exploring, especially large-scale projects. Large-scale projects also often have very elaborate on-site mitigation plans that include all of those different things that I've talked about. So when we're talking about, I don't want to pull any out, but you all know the big developments in the area and they often have large scale on-site. So they are usually not using mitigation banks. Just one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Have there been any occasions where a bank has failed?
You're recognized.
I would have to defer an answer on that. I can get back to you on that. We have a technical program manager, and I know at St. John's, we do everything we can to work with those bankers to keep things moving and try to help them through any stumbling blocks they might come across as they're implementing their bank or trying to implement it in perpetual management. But I could definitely get you that information.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Maggard, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for your presentation. Mitigation banks can sometimes be interesting. So you did a fine job on explaining that. For the good of the committee, please, because some members may not know, can you explain what UMAM means so they understand how this relates to how a mitigation bank is set up and what a UMAM does and what the score does, please, if you can?
You're recognized.
So the Uniform Mitigation Assessment Method was established so that we could quantify both impacts and mitigation. And we look at them in three parameters. We look at location and landscape, we look at water environment, and we look at community structure. So when we're looking at an impact site, we're looking at what's going to happen to that in post-development. Well, in most cases, the location and landscape, the water environment, and the community structure are lost. If we have a fill impact, we've lost those functions. So those go down to zero. You have a scale of 10, 0 to 10 in each one of those three categories. So it becomes an elaborate mathematical equation that you factor in what the functional loss is based on your scoring. So if you have an average wetland, it might be a 6, 5, 7, you know, for those three attributes. On the mitigation side of things, we are looking at the mitigation bank and saying, okay, we currently have this community structure, that being the vegetation, and there's a whole set of parameters that are associated with what we call community structure. We have this community structure, and what are they going to do in their plan that's going to make that better? And then once they do that plan, what will that new score be? So perhaps we're at a 3 because it has low functions because it's a monoculture. Then they implement the plan, and now we've got a nice, diverse community. And so that raises up to a 7 or an 8. And so that's how they're getting a lift. And they're doing it on the community structure side, on the water environment side. So say they're plugging ditches. Now the wetland is more hydrated than it used to be. And location and landscape. So they're tying things up. We're connecting perhaps one state-owned property with another, with this bank in the middle, and it'll be under conservation easement. So we've created a corridor. So we've improved that location and landscape there. So when we look at what is going to be implemented, we look at how those functions are gained.
It's a great question.
That could be a whole talk all in itself.
Right, appreciate it. Representative Cassell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, Representative Waldron asked my question.
Okay, very good. Representative Overdorf.
Thank you so much. This is something that I deal with all the time, your staff is very highly trained. I appreciate how they do it and what they do. One of the items that we're looking at right now is basically a shortage of credits throughout the state. And we've seen that from Pensacola to Miami. One of those areas is obviously within your district as well. It's ironic that you mentioned Basin 4 earlier. That being said, as you're reviewing the permitting, have you ever issued a permit that does not have a federal MBI as well as the state MBI, mitigation banking instrument?
You're recognized?
We do have mitigation banks in the state of Florida that do not have associated MBIs. So we have some banks that only have state credits versus those federal credits. So we wouldn't issue a permit on the federal side, but we try to work with the Army Corps as part of the IRT team to coordinate what's proposed on a bank site. But sometimes their permitting either takes longer or it might be that the applicant, the banker, decided that they weren't going to get the federal permit. They might need to get, they might need to get some type of notice general or some other authorization from the Corps to do the work that is proposed on a mitigation bank site, though.
Do you have a follow-up?
Yes, please. So knowing that there's, obviously, state, federal, the feds right now are taking about 5 years from what I see to approve a mitigation bank. The state seems to take about 18 months. Maybe a little less, depending on which consultant's doing it and which state agency. That being said, in reviewing this, we currently have areas and basins that have zero credits, yet there are projects that want to move ahead. And knowing that we got increased interest rates, cost of goods, cost of materials, cost of labor, is there an opportunity to potentially look at the federal proximity factor, which is a known method of potentially allowing for a mitigation credit to be then brought over to a adjacent basin or something along those lines?
I think it's a good question, but I'm not sure you're in a position to do a policy projection. But if you want to address that, you may. But I want to cover that in case. So seemed a little beyond the scope.
Yeah, I would say we have our current regulations that are in place, and they don't allow for that at this point. If that's something that is brought before us to comment on or is implemented by our legislature, then obviously we would implement it accordingly. But at this point, we don't have that in our toolbox. What we do try to do for those folks is we try to come up with other options. I've looked at projects where we've been able to phase a project and say, okay, let's do this phase because you've got enough credits. You can get out there, start moving dirt, and then you come back and get a modification to take care of that second phase when credits are available. We've been successful with that a couple of times. We've been successful in connecting consultants to talk to see what else is out there in a timelier fashion than maybe our next release of credits. And we have started working with our mitigation bankers to really jump on any of their requests when they have requests for release of credits so that we can be at the forefront. We're trying to take a look at that. Our technical program manager provides us a list of where credits are available, at least based on our current ledgers, so that we can let applicants know that too. And some folks are buying them ahead of time. There's a lot of different options out there that we've tried to implement to keep people moving through the permit process.
Ms. Wenzel's been on the floor, been briefing us, and we've been grilling her for 40 minutes now. You have one more small question, maybe?
Not necessarily a question, but a commentary. First of all, I would say that, unfortunately, there are no credits right now in many of the basins that we're trying to deal with. So look forward to working with you on opportunities to be able to make those available. Mm-hmm. But the second, I would just caution that I don't think that we should be utilizing public lands for wetland mitigation projects, only because of the layers of complication associated with that, and that combined with House Bill 1379 from last year, looking at water quality projects that probably need to be done by the local governments to achieve the TMDL standards. So I think it's something that, you know, is going to be, again, layered and complicated, more of a, not a question, more of a commentary. So, but thank you so much for your presentation today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. We always appreciate you bringing your lived experience. And I do have one last question from Representative Henson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I agree with Representative Oberdorf. I have to say that. We don't do that often. And also, the question from Rep. Maggard evoked some other questions for me. And I really enjoyed the way you've presented with great confidence and clarity, and you seem to enjoy your work. The connectivity was a question I had earlier, and you kind of brought that to light with the uniform, whatever. Do you get to offer options other than mitigation banks? In other words, if they came to you and they wanted the mitigation bank option, and you could present another option similar to the way you just described that question, like preservation and creation of other ecosystems and how it would enhance what they're doing with the lay of the land and the better good or whatever. Do you get to offer those options as opposed to a mitigation bank?
You're recognized.
We generally do not offer options if an applicant has proposed something. It's not our job to design their project or to come up with mitigation options unless they are short on mitigation. They can't find any. Then we start tossing out ideas. So if somebody comes to me and says, hey, I want to buy mitigation bank credits, we are not in the business to say, how about this instead? That's not how we work. We do, oftentimes folks will preserve what's kind of left on the property a lot of times. So we do get a combination of mitigation. So it could be some on-site preservation and the purchase of mitigation bank credits. So there's often a combination, but no, we don't deter them from utilization of mitigation banks.
Thank you. And I wanted to just thank you, both of our presenters today. Thank you for your very informative presentation, and DEP Deputy Secretary Kramer for her introduction as well. It's been really interesting, and you have to put things into numbers to kind of equate, and so you've really filled in a lot of gaps in understanding, provide us a foundation for issues we may be considering, you know, this session or in future sessions. So I really appreciate your time and your expertise in laying that foundation for this committee. And I thank all the members for the really good information and questions to help illuminate this subject. Thank you. Thank you so much. Very gracious. And hopefully you'll come back if we need you as well. Thank you. Thank you. Members, this concludes our committee agenda, and I really appreciate you staying for this, and I know a lot of people had a clear calendar other than coming for this meeting, and I'm really grateful and want to be respectful of your time. This concludes our agenda, and seeing no further business before the committee, Representative Cross moves we rise. Meeting without further objections, the meeting is adjourned.